As I understand it, you two girls came to Granny Gibb at the Grove.
Yes.
And your mother had to support herself, and she had Will.
Yes.
And was where? In Port Erin.
Yes. And eventually, Grandfather had the brew along the front.
Grandfather Turnbull.
Yes. And he built a house for Mother. And she did very well letting rooms in the summer to people. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, now there was a Greek family who came over and they brought two maids, I think, with them. But they didn't want Mother to leave the house. And that suited her. And they took it for, I think, a month or two in the summer, you see. And she could live there. And she had nothing to do, really, for them.
No.
But be there.
And your grandfather Turnbull was still alive?
Yes. I'm trying to remember what year he died, but I just can't.
And when you girls wanted to go to see your mother...
Well, we always...
I mean, how did you go?
We went by the train, you see, and we always spent part of our summer holidays there. And latterly, I think it was the Easter holidays we went for, because in the summer holidays, the house was generally let, you see.
Yes.
And then, of course, after Will left King William's, he went to sea, and I think Mother did, for a while, go on letting part of the house in the summer, but he was getting good wages, and eventually he gave up the sea in somewhere in the 20s, I think, because everything was very low, and he said the other men needed the work to support their families, and he knew that he would be all right. He'd saved while he was at sea, and also he could help at Grandfather's, and they would... He knew, anyhow, that he wouldn't starve.
Yeah.
And some of the other engineers, you see, would, with their families, they've nothing to fall back on.
No. And you tell me that when you went to your grandfather's, or I suppose to your mother's, that you used to go round with him, and he taught you to read.
Yes. Yes, in those days, we knew most of the people in Port Erin. Now I hardly know a soul.
No.
Of course, naturally, I've outlived all the generation, you see.
Mm.
And not living there, just going there for short visits, you don't get to know the younger ones of the next generation like we have done here.
No. You were saying that that as you drove round, your grandfather would make you spell out the words on the posters and things like that.
Always. Oh, yes, he taught me to read in that way. I never remember learning to read. I never remember that I couldn't read. And he taught Will in the same way.
It's a very painless way.
Mm.
And then another thing you were telling me that I'd love to sort of hear something about, you were talking about, was it Joseph of Ballachalingan?
Yes.
Now, who was he? Joseph who?
Well, of course, Mrs. Edward Ferrant, you see, was a Miss Collister, a sister of Mrs. Clucas of Thornhill. She was very nice, She had a red head, and that was where Jörn and Hilda got their red hair from. And she really was in love with Charlie Nelson, but her father wouldn't hear of it much. Oh, he was furious. Must have been a queer old man, Mr. Collister. Of course, I never knew him. And when Edward Ferrant proposed for her, he said, yes, you can marry him.
Joseph was the coachman, was he? Joseph was the coachman,
yes,
was he?
Yes, Joseph.
Joseph whom?
Joseph Callow.
Joseph Callow.
Yes.
And wasn't he very much in demand for parties and so on?
Oh, very
much. Tell me about that again.
Yes, very much. Oh, yes, and anywhere he went. Now, at that time, there was an annual garden party at Bishop's Court. First of all, with the Hills, I think, and then with the Bardsleys. And Joseph would drive Mrs. Tarrant and anyone else who was staying with her there, you see. I can't remember exactly when Edward Ferrant died. And then he would go and offer to help. People were always so glad of his help because he was so, neat and quick about it. And he'd see if anyone hadn't their tea and would supply them and all that kind of thing.
Did he come to the Grove here ever to help at parties?
Oh, yes,
here?
The only garden party I remember. After that, Granny was too old to have garden parties. He came here, and of course he was very much at home here, and so he just helped and went in and out at the back, and of course the maids loved having him. I don't remember much about it, except I remember seeing the carriages come up to the front here, a pair of horses looking very nice, and then they went round the corner this way. You see, to go out that way. They didn't have to turn, they just went out. Joseph said it was very handy.
And were these open carriages?
A land door, that open door shut.
Yes. Pair of horses.
And they looked so nice. Like that picture.
Like that picture.
Johnny Dan's.
Yes, yes, yes. And another thing I wanted to ask you about was to tell me again, now I've got this machine here, about the snow of 1897, did you say it was?
92, I think.
1892,
it
was it?
I think it was 92. And I can't think where the big picture is of the snow. We had it, it was about for a long time, or it may have got burnt. But I know that it was a snowy morning, nothing very great, but it was snowy and the place looked very grey and so on. And Granny wouldn't let us go to school that afternoon. She said, you mightn't get home again. Well, some of the children went to school, the two Vondi girls, and they were stuck there for a week. They,
good Lord.
I don't know, the roads were bad and slippery and all together, and their father thought they were better there than at home. And then Miss Westbrook had a few boarders, and there was room for them, so they got their lessons all the time while we had a week's holiday.
And you said that the level of the snow around the Grove here,
yes,
was up to the height of the wall.
Yes.
And that your coachman or something had
to... He had to walk along the stone wall to get here, you see, when he got to Richmond's Corner, he said the little bit that he walked before he got to the wall the first morning, he sank in up to his waist nearly. He was wet through. I think the maids gave him hot drinks and told him to go home again when he had opened up the cows and fed them and the horse. But he walked on the wall because he knew he wouldn't sink there.
And what about the snow up against the door of the house?
It kept him warm anyway, but he had to dig out the hens and the stable and the cows and the back door. He dug the back door out first.
Is that the biggest snow you remember ever here?
I never remember such a snow as that. And I think people will tell you that it was the first and the last of what we'd had, a really big snowstorm. But the north of the island was very badly hit. But they got it in the south too. It was general all over.
And another thing that you know is interesting today, the road from here to Douglas.
Yes.
There would be no tarmac.
No.
Was it metalled, as they call it? Was it?
Yes. It was indeed a sandy road, and on a dusty day it was very dusty, even though it was metalled.
And what about Ramsey itself? Were the roads there sort of metalled and sandy?
They were, to begin with, they were only kind of gravel put on them at intervals, and then there were pools, and when you walked you took good care to keep out of the pools.
When was the first sort of metalling in the middle of Ramsey, roughly?
Oh, I suppose somewhere about 1890, I should think. That kind of thing pretty well modernized in the way of harder and metal roads by 95. Wasn't that the second Jubilee year?
98.
Yes.
98.
And they began 97. To look up and improve things in 85, the first Jubilee.
And what about the road to Douglas in those days?
Well, of course, in the very early days when they first came here, they had to take that narrow road that goes down. When you come to Laxey, there's a road on your left that takes you down to the shore and up the other side again.
Yes.
Well, then, some years later, there was a second road made there that wasn't quite so steep. You went a little further along and you still went down and up again. And then I can't remember when the other road really was made. I only know that by the time of the first Jubilee, I think the present road was either getting made or was made.
And what about this end? If you were going to Douglas from Ramsey, did you go up Slough Leg to Hibernia as now?
Yes,
or did you go out towards Dreams Carry and
No, over? you went up Slough Leg.
The same road as now?
Yes, that's the same road as now.
And what about that house on the corner that I always call Rest and Be Thankful?
Well, it was built In the days of horses, when everybody had to walk, if you went in the coach or anything, they stopped at the bottom of that bit of hill. They stopped just when you come round of the corner by the loo, and you were asked, would you mind walking? And they would say, well, Auntie, if we were there, the old lady needn't walk, that was Auntie, but we'd walk. And then that was built as a pub, because people were always thankful to get a drink there in the summertime. They were hot and thirsty, you see. And now I believe it's two flats nowadays.
It's up for sale now. Mm. It's just up for sale.
Oh, is it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, a Mrs. I never thought of asking her, did she still live there? Mrs. Carruthers. She and he, they lived somewhere, I think, in the south of the island to begin with when they first came here. And then they had a house in Richmond's Lane. They're great walkers. And then they took that house on the hill because they'd walked all this end of Ramsey over and over again, Point of Air and Derby Church and Old Balaff and out to Kirkmichael and up the hill, Cronkavoddy and so on. Then they thought they'd go and live up there where they'd walk that end, Mochald and towards Douglas and up by Lonnon Church and there, and up the old turf road by, now how do you get there? You go up, anyhow you go up from Laxey and you don't turn up the road to the Beljane farm, you go straight ahead and you come to a turf road. I've been up it once. Because I know we went up in a motor car.
Did you? And you would remember, of course, very well the opening of the electric railway.
Yes. But, oh, there was a fuss about that. My cousin, Katie Reed, married an Edinburgh WS, and Jimmy was very, he also had a very large farm, 500 acres, which his family had had for generations from Lord Linlithgow. And they were both over here, and there was this project about the electric railway. And it cuts right through the Beljane farm that belonged then to my grandmother, and afterwards Will had it and sold it to Parsons. And Mr. Bruce was Granny's trustee or man of business or something.
The Dumble Bank Bruce.
Yes.
Yes.
And he said, oh, yes, I know that property. You can have that land for a song. And when Jimmy heard that, he was raging. Song indeed, cutting the farm in two. And think of the trouble if there's in the summer when there's much traffic and the man wants to get his cows or his sheep across the lines. Oh, no, that won't do at all. So he went to see Mr. Nelson about it, and he said to him, now you can't be the lawyer for that land and for the electric railway too, so you must give up one or the other. And Charlie Nelson said he didn't see why he couldn't be. Oh no, he said, you can't play fair. He said, I'm seeing to that now. And so things were all removed from Charlie Nelson and given to Mr. Cruikshank. And instead of a mere nothing, Granny got quite a handsome sum because they cut the farm in two.
And Mr. Bruce was then one of the promoters of the electric railway.
Oh, yes. That was one of the schemes that helped to bring them down. I think only to begin with, it really wasn't an unprofitable. It paid well, I think, to begin with.
But then later, this contributed to the Dumbles Bank troubles.
Yes.
And did you ride on the first tram car from Ramsey? Did you ride on the first tram car from Ramsey or anything
like
that?
No, I don't think so. We were in very bad odour with the...
directors?
With the people, Mr. Bruce and the other people, because Jimmy had come over and found what they were after and that they could have the land for a song. And I think they took it to court, and he said that he was a farmer, and he knew perfectly well the trouble it would be with trams coming and going, and you wanting to get your sheep to a good valley that was across the line. So he got quite a handsome sum out of that instead of just a nominal thing. Oh, Mr. Bruce didn't love him a bit.
Where did Mr. Bruce live?
Now, of course, it was very awkward because Mr. Bruce was a friend of the family, and when the Bank of Mona smashed and he and Mrs. Bruce had nowhere, well, I think they were, you know, penniless practically. Not quite, but I know Granny had them here, invited them to come and stay here for quite a while. That was, I don't know, and I can remember them being here.
Then he was taken on by Mr. Dumble.
Yes.
And put to the top again.
Yes. You see, they knew he was a clever man and perhaps quite good at finance, but he just lost his head in the end. Most of the things that he had done had been a profit and worked well, and he just lost his head. And you see, now George Trustham was one of the things, I think, and Harry Clegg of the Bellevue Hotel, well, he was... What was Harry Clegg? Harry Clegg was a nephew of grandfather's, I think. His mother was a Turnbull, yes. Harry Clegg insisted on having his money in cash, you see. He wasn't going to leave it on the thing or to be paid bits. He must have the price in cash, which he did. And I think the other man was the same. And was... Really, that frightened the powerhouse people. And Mr. Milchrist, who'd been sent over to look into things, I think they'd advanced too far to draw back altogether. But they did draw back in a sense that they wouldn't take it over as it was. They opened the bank again quite shortly under Power's name, but they didn't, I think Dumbles had to clear up.
Liquidate Dumbles,
yes.
And reopen. When the Manx Electric Railway opened, did people change from the old steam train to go to the electric railway if you wanted to go to Douglas?
Oh, I think they did to begin with, you know, especially if you didn't want to go to Balaf or any of these places. They did for partly the variety of scenery and partly it was a new thing. And all the Australians that we've had here have all wanted to go to Douglas by the electric, partly because of the view and partly because it seems to be a kind of novelty.
Yes.
I know when Elsie Farley came here the first time, it was a horrid day. I didn't really think she... Oh, yes, she must go and go in the toast rack too. It was quite... Oh, no, she wouldn't go inside, nothing of the kind. So we went in the toast rack. And by the time we got to Laxey, she was so cold, she was thankful to get into the closed car in front. And when we got into Douglas, before we went, we were going to have our lunch in Douglas, before we got anything to eat, she said, I think I'm going to try and buy a jumper. This cardigan isn't enough. I want something more warm. So she said, I want something that'll go with it, but I don't suppose I'll be able to match it in any way. I think perhaps a complete contrast would be best, only I don't want black. Because she said, I bought this in Sydney before I left. So I said, well, sales is said to be quite good. Let's go in there and see. And I said, they won't mind if you don't see anything you like. Don't take it. We'll go and try another. Into sales we went, and the man downstairs said, oh, the ladies' jumpers upstairs. So upstairs we went. Very nice young woman came to us, and so Elsie explained what she wanted, and the girl smiled, and she said, well, if it's the right size, I think I can suit you. So she went to a drawer and pulled out a whole bundle of very nice looking things, and she picked out one. It was the exact twin of her cardigan.
Is it?
And she looked at her and she said, well, to think I bought this cardigan in Sydney and now you supply me with its twin here. And the girl said, oh, well, you know, it's quite likely we British firms do send a lot abroad, and most likely your firm in Sydney got them from the same place as this. Oh, she was terribly pleased about it. She never forgot. Fancy, she kept telling everybody she bought the cardigan in Sydney and the jumper in Douglas.
Mm.
It was a coincidence.
When you were in your teens, you know, 15, yes. 16, and so on, were there a lot of parties going on in the north here?
Oh, yes, there were. There were, but they were quite different to the parties of today. We did, in the summer, of course, we did most of the sort of getting together ourselves. In the summer of 1910, I think it was. It was a wonderful summer, much too hot to play tennis, and we picnicked on 28 out of the 31 days in August. Up in those days, the river hadn't been cleared, and when there was a good tide, we could get up as far as Loch Nyai. And we picnicked up the river. I think we picnicked in every available place. And we had a pony and a governor's cart at that time. And I always drove in the cart with the provisions and so on. And Addis generally cycled with the crowd. We went to Barraglass and to Glenmore. And all the various bays and things round Mottled Head and the Point of Ayr and Blue Point. And what's that other one near Belaugh? Belaugh Shore.
Yeah. And how many of you? 20 or 12?
Yes. Well, I know the one day up the river we were 28.
Boys and girls, yes. Or young men and women?
Yes, well, boys and girls to begin with, and they grew up. You see, our three cousins, Scott and the twins, were three, and there were four boys at Ballacurry, that was seven, and there were three holiday cousins named Broadbelt, who came here every summer for their holidays, stayed with the old Miss Shepherds, because the Miss Shepherds and their parents had been friends somewhere in Cheshire before the Shepherds came to live here. So that was 10 boys, and we'd look for 10 girls to go with us, you see. Mm. And we got them, generally.
And what about winter parties?
Well, the winter parties, well, one winter we had 10, that was the biggest number in the winter holidays when the lads were not at school or college.
And what sort of...
There was a Miss... What was her name? I was thinking of her the other day. Mills, I think, who played. She gave music lessons, and she was very glad to come out and play for a party, you see. And I know we had her here, nearly everybody had her. And the Crellins that year had a good party in St. Olive's School, and we had two parties here, 2 weeks running. We thought when we'd taken the door off the drawing room, it was a pity not to have a second one. So we had two parties, and we'd grown the turkey, for both, I think, two turkeys. And
Did you dance, or did you...
Danced, yes, they all danced. I remember so well at the Crellin's party down in the St. Olive's School. Gorgie, who was then, oh, I don't know, perhaps about 14. He was the youngest, you see. And he was very drowsy. And I had been sitting talking to him, and Mrs. Crellin came up. "My son," she said, "you're ready to go home to bed. I have tasted every drink that was on that table," he said, "whiskey and all." She said, "no wonder you're sleepy."
Which was this John's brother?
John's youngest brother.
John's youngest brother.
He was 6 or 7 years younger than John. I remember that. Funny little things that stick in your memory, isn't it?
Yes, yes, it is. It's extraordinary.
She was a charming woman, John's mother. A delightful woman. Sophie Anderson. All the young men of her generation were sweet about her. And I believe my cousin Major Scott and she flirted so riotously one summer that John's father thought, "I'm going to lose her if I don't get hold of her quickly." But I think it was largely done to spur him on. Willie Scott was very good at that kind of thing.
And John Crellin's father, he would be the one, was he, who did Mrs. Jarley's waxworks and things like that.
Yes.
My mother, in her diary, talks about John Crellin, or in the newspaper, it talks about, you know, fates at Andreas.
Yes.
And Mr. John Crellin...
That would be this...
...gave Mrs. Jarley's waxworks.
Yes, that would be John's father.
Did you see Mrs. Jarley's waxworks? No. What were they about? Was evident as some sort of impersonation. Of
yes. And done with real people, very likely, you know.
I see. sort of Madame Tussauds,
yes,
but with real people pretending to be waxworks.
Yes.
And another thing, one reads about certain of the old customs, like, you know, hunting the wren and
yes,
that sort of thing. Now, did you ever take part in any of those?
No, we weren't allowed, but I've taken money to the children at the door with the pole decorated in a sort of cage on the top of it, you know, and collecting and singing Hunt the Wren.
And this took place when?
Now.
It's Good Friday, wasn't it?
I think so.
I think so.
I think it was. And then there were the white boys with Miss Stoyle, the schoolmaster man down Castletown. I wonder if he's alive still. He resurrected that, which really was quite entertaining. We had a... When he was schoolmaster here, he had a quite a good team of boys who did that. It was a sort of little kind of a play, the white boys. And then there was the mullet band that the men had all top hats decorated with branches of holly and various. That was at Christmas time always. And I know they nearly frightened the life out of me the first time I saw them.
What was this, the mullard?
Yes, they...
How do you spell it? M-U-L-L-A-R-D?
A-G-H, I think.
Oh, mullock, yes.
They know something about that at the museum, I should think. It seemed largely to have died out, but I remember I... wasn't very big, and I was, the housemaid was out, I think, and I was sitting in the kitchen on the fender, and the cook was reading to me, and suddenly the door opened and this apparition came in. I looked up, I thought the devil had come after me, and I fled to the front of the house screaming at the top of my voice, and they came out of the drawing room to see what was the matter. And then I don't know what I said, that there was something awful in the kitchen. Auntie went down to see. The men were then invited to come up to the hall and go through whatever the thing was, and they got some money and went.
When you say band, did they have
they
proper
had some
instruments?
Accordion and you know. And then in those days, the choir always, the St. Paul's Choir, men and boys always came to sing carols to Granny. And I don't think they could sing much after they left here because they'd large pieces of cake and oranges and apples and things. I think this must have been their last port of call, I don't know.
Good opportunity for your cake here. I'll bring them up, Miss Gibb. Yes.
Yes, I'm rather sorry, but that's the worst of electric cooking.
Mm.
It's they nearly always slightly overdo the cakes, that they're just on the dry side. And though I put all the ingredients and everything, I didn't bake it.
Yeah.
But Nell baked it to perfection always, and part of it would have lasted through into the summer and not been too dry,
yeah,
because Duncan always expects when he comes over for the King William's match in March, he comes down to have cake and ginger wine in the morning beforehand, because he said, doesn't do to eat too much lunch because your wind isn't so good. Duncan's getting too old to play rugger. But he talks. Perhaps it's only to come to the dinner, the old boys' dinner. The Shepherdy talks of coming in March.
Good.
Hmm. He's 34.
Yes, well, he's just about, you know, just about getting near the end. Another thing interests me very much, because my mother was a very early participant.
Yes.
The Manx Musical Guild.
Oh, yes.
Now, did Miss M.L. Wood, did she start the guild, or was she its first conductor, or what do you know about it?
Oh, well, she did start it in this way, that she helped W.H. Gill, you know, the music man.
Yes.
And between them, I think, and I can't think, there was someone else in Douglas at that time who was very great with the guild and a great help. And, of course, she helped it all she could, and her choirs and her things. I know she, at that time, she held a kind of singing class at Miss Westbrook's. That was the school we went to. And she, I didn't go up. I think I was just over age. Anyhow, I was just one too many. And they had plenty of contraltos without me. And I can remember now the first words, I sing because I love to sing. And she was awfully pleased with them at the last rehearsal. I can remember quite well. Now, if you'll sing like that, she said, when we come to the guild, I'm sure we'll take a prize. She'd several other choirs too, and I probably said the same thing to all of them. But they did. They came on and they sang. It was only a short thing. And the judge said he'd never heard anything more spirited or more delightful. And there was no doubt that they were streets ahead of any other choir on the stage.
Was Miss Wood a Douglas woman?
No, I don't know that she was.
She wasn't?
Because her brother was the doctor here.
Oh.
I don't know. Of course, she wasn't young.
And the initials on the little medals that my mother won,
yes,
are F, A, and I, G. Would you know what those stand for?
Now, I don't at the moment. I think the RSD is someone's initials.
It looks as though it is some title, you know, like, what could it be? It's difficult to say, as though the G is for guild, for instance. F, A, and I, G.
F-A.
And those medals are 1894. They were the second year of the guild, you were saying?
Yes.
When my mother was...
she was awfully interested in that. And you know, she took the Andreas Choir up, the church choir for village choirs.
Yes.
And I think they came home with the first prize several times.
They did indeed. They did indeed, yes.
Yes. Oh, yes, she was terribly keen about it.
Now, you mentioned W.H. Gill.
Yes.
He, of course, was responsible for the adaptation, really, of Dr. John Clegg's,
yes,
researches, wasn't he?
Yes.
Did you ever know Dr. Clegg? Ever,
yes,
meet him?
Oh, yes. He was the family doctor at Portieren, and such a very nice man. Very.
Well, perhaps you can clear up a mystery for me, because I think it is Cubbon in Island Heritage.
Yes.
Who says he was from Ballinorris, And some other book says he was from Bala Clegg. Would you know which he was? It doesn't matter if you don't know.
No.
But I noticed two books.
Yes.
One says Bala Norris, and the other says Bala Clegg. And,
yes.
You know, I just wondered if you knew. What sort of age was Dr. Clegg then when you knew him? 50?
Well, I should say he was a middle-aged man. He might have been, you know, to girls in their teens.
Mm.
You're never very certain about.
No.
But he was very musical, you know, and very interested in helping W.H. Gill to get tunes from the old people and words from this, that, and the other.
Did you know W.H. Gill personally?
No, I didn't.
Because he, as you know, was also a cousin of mine. He was, you know, another of...
Yes, of course he was.
...the Malew family.
Yes.
Mm. And then Deemster Fred was the third in the trio, wasn't he?
Yes.
Deemster Fred Gill.
Yes.
He and Clegg began it. And W.H., I think, came in afterwards.
I think so.
Hmm. And another rather famous Manxman of those days, did you ever know Speaker Arthur Moore?
Only very slightly. I met him. My old aunt knew him.
Because he was a very remarkable man.
Yes, very.
Did you ever go to Cronkbourne?
No, I don't think I ever was at Cronkbourne while they were there.
Mm.
But of course, now wait a minute. Wasn't one of the Cronkbourne Moors a Mrs. Hughes Games? Now what was that connection? No, I'm wrong. One of the Hughes Games married Arthur Moore.
Oh, yes.
That was it. Mm-hmm. Well, one was Mrs. Ring, I think, and another was Mrs. Arthur Moore.
And the elder Nicholson, the painter.
Yes.
Did you ever know him?
No, I didn't.
And Hoggett was earlier, wasn't he, than you?
Yes.
And Hoggett, the painter. Because he lived near Port Erin, didn't he?
Yes.
But he was earlier.
He was.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. I knew him.
Oh, did you?
Yes, I knew him and his wife. Not very well, you know, but I knew him.
What was he like? What was his background?
He was frightfully keen about his painting and the views in the island and everything. He never wanted to go, after he got here, he never wanted to go anywhere else. And he was always hunting round for bits to paint, the old mill at Sulby, I know, and various other things. And Mrs. Hoggett was, I think, very artistic. I know she... She always wore kind of flyaway hats and bits and pieces when it wasn't the fashion to have flyaway hats and bits and pieces. Lace scarves floating out and...
Yeah. What was Hoggett's background?
I don't know. I don't know what brought him to the island, but once he came, he never went away again. And he bought the old Darug house up on the way up to Mule from Port Erin, and they lived there until he died, I think.
And was he famous in his lifetime?
Oh, yes. I think every year he had pictures in the, in spring, in London.
Royal Academy?
Yes.
What sort of price did you have to pay for a Hoggett in those days?
About £50, I think.
Mm-hmm. Fair price.
Now, I may be wrong, but I think that when Sally was married, he gave her a small picture. He was still alive, and I think he gave her a small picture. Of course, Will knew him very well.
Yes, he would do. And one other person who is renowned in this area, Canon Peyton,
yes.
St. Paul's. My reading tells me that he was more or less the originator of poor relief and all these sort of things.
Yes, he was.
Original schooling and all the rest of it.
Yes. Well, you see, there was no infant school here, and he built the old Cross Hall at his own expense as an infant school. And of course, when it was condemned, well, of course, that was that. And it was the most useful place. If only the church had been able to buy it then, we'd never have had to bother with this new thing, because all sorts, tea parties and everything, were held there. It was quite a good size with a nice little stage for concerts and all sorts of things. And in those days, the St. Paul's Tea Party, there were six, if not eight, long tables. I wonder what the... was Mrs. Bates and Mrs. Cruikshank and Mrs. Tumman and Mrs. Gill and Mrs. Peyton and Mrs. Bates. And I wonder if there were two more. And then we had service, and then we'd a tea fight. And the ladies who had tables, some of them added things. Now, Mrs. Henry Gill, he was a grocer here. She always had honey, I think. Or was it she who had ginger? No, she always had honey. And Mrs. Tubman always had ginger, preserved ginger for a jam, you see. And Mrs. Gill had honey. And somebody else had strawberry jam always. And you went to the table where you liked the jam. And Auntie had so many friends, she never wanted to eat much, but she went round to half the tables having a cup of tea at each. That's my earliest recollection of it. I think I've got a piece of paper. Yeah. Peyton at the end of his day. That's poor, of course. We've got a very good photograph somewhere of that. He really was a wonderful man. when you come to think of it, because he was clever as well as a good parson. When he was at college in Edinburgh, he started life by thinking he'd go in for law. But he soon gave that up because it was too tricky, he said. He would never make a good lawyer. So then he thought he'd be a doctor. And he was Professor Syme's dresser. And Professor Syme said to him one day, "Peyton, you'll never do for a doctor. Every patient that dies, you'll think you've killed them. Turn your attention to something else, my lad." And he came home and repeated that. And somebody suggested, "Well, you better go into the church." So back he went to Edinburgh and went into the church. But he didn't want to go into the Presbyterian church. He wanted to go into the Church of England, which he did. And his friends were people like Arthur Balfour and what was the other man? Gladstone and people like that. And he, once he became the parson of Ramsey, he never wanted anything else. There were letters from Arthur Balfour offering him posts in London and vicars of this or that or the other. He turned them all down. He'd lost his heart to the island and the Manx fishermen. And he'd go along the quay, when we'd ever so many fishing boats in those days, and the men would all come up from their boats, all so glad to see him and have a word and all that.
Wonderful, isn't it?
And the average congregation on a Sunday evening in the winter, the galleries were full of fishermen and their wives and so on, were about 300. Amazing, isn't it?
It is amazing.
Well, of course, I wouldn't know that, only that Sybil Peyton told me years afterwards. She said, "Well, you know, before Father died, the average congregation on a Sunday evening was about 300. Because there was no wireless, no anything.
No.
So they all came to church. And he was always so careful to choose hymns that were popular. Not like our present vicar, who likes trying new things. We had the old ones, which everybody knew. And I know on a stormy Sunday evening, we'd always have "Eternal Father, Strong to Save." What was the other thing I was thinking about? Oh, yes, and that I think Mark lost it. There was a delightful prayer that he heard in Cornwall once about the fishermen and at sea. And we always had it every Sunday evening, storm or no storm. And I think Mark must have lost it when he got a new prayer book and Bible. It was written by somebody down in Cornwall, particularly for fisher folk. And Mr. Peyton was down there one time. I don't know whether he'd gone to preach or